Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm here for a second time with Dr. Sarah Hill. She is an associate professor of psychology at Texas Christian University. And we are here today basically to talk about a book that is about to be released. This is Your Brain on Birth Control: The Surprising Science of Women, Hormones, and the Law of Unintended Consequences. So I think that by the time I release this interview, the book will be released tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, but it's something like that. So, Dr. Hill, thank you a lot for taking the time again to come on the show.
No, thank you for having me.
Okay, great. So, I mean, before we get into what the pill is about and the effects that it has on women's bodies, and that includes the brains and the minds, I would probably like to ask you first, could you tell us what are some of the main aspects of women's behavior when it comes to, for example, mate preferences, and sexual activity and things like that? That you think are important for people to take into account when we're dealing with the effects that the pill has on women's minds and where they come from, of course.
Right. So, the idea with the book is that the sort of first kind of big point is that our brain creates the experience of being who we are, right? And like, so who the person that we think of as us is a product of what our brain is doing. And one of the key features of our brain that influences how we think and how we feel and how we behave are the activities of our sex hormones. And so our sex hormones influence, as you sort of alluded to, everything ranging from our mate preferences to the nature of our stress response, to our emotional responses. It even influences things, like immune function and some other things like outside of the brain that we wouldn't even think, have a relationship to sex hormones. But because pregnancy and conception is like so sort of important in terms of the evolutionary process, but also just so it requires women's bodies to find so many different workarounds that the impact of sex hormones on everything ranging from mate preferences to our stress response are influenced by hormones that we take in the birth control pill.
But I mean, in terms of how women's brains get influenced by the pill, what are the sorts of aspects that you would like to focus most on? I mean, in terms of mate preferences and mating behavior, and maybe perhaps just give us a brief overview of the evolutionary basis of those types of things.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so we can focus on mate preferences since that's something that there's been, quite a bit of research into. And like just sort of as the backstory, there's been research now for over a decade, probably several decades, if we sort of include everything related to sex hormones and women's mate preferences sort of in this category. But there's been research now for, there's a pretty substantial body of research demonstrating that women's sex hormones influence who they're attracted to and who they want to partner with. And that this, we sort of see this evidenced by changes that we find in women's mate preferences that occur over the menstrual cycle. So, for example, there's a lot of research indicating that at high fertility, so times during the cycle when estrogen is high relative to progesterone, when conception is possible, that during this time, Women really seem to be picking up on cues to, masculinity. I mean, there's research showing that women are just like more in tune with men at this time. There's research showing that women are more in tune with attractive men at this time. There's research showing that women, their levels of estrogen across the cycle sort of predict their preference for testosterone, with estrogen levels predicting the levels of testosterone in the people that they're preferring as partners. And so there's been a great deal of research indicating that that sex hormones seem to play a role in like who women are really feeling attracted to. And of course, what this means is that when you take the birth control pill, which is something that alters a woman's hormonal status, so it suppresses her own, internal endogenous, internally produced hormones, keeps those levels really low, and then instead, women are experiencing this sort of hormonal situation with these artificial hormones from the birth control pill. That keep, the relative levels of the artificial progesterone to artificial estrogen are such that, it's going to lead to different types of meat preferences, presumably, than what is observed in naturally cycling women who have this sort of ebb and flow of their hormones over the course of the cycle. And so there's been research now, and the research has been sort of, hit and miss. There's been some research that finds support for the idea that women who are on the birth control pill, when they choose their partners, choose as partners men with more feminine faces, and that women on the pill prefer a more feminine male face compared to what we observe with naturally cycling women. And there has been some research that has failed to replicate this effect. And so the results right now are still mixed in terms of whether and to what degree the pill influences mate preferences. But given the really substantial body of research showing that women's sex hormones influence who they're attracted to, there's really no reason to believe that the birth control pill should leave this unperturbed, given that it's changing women's levels of sex hormones. That's going to mean that, given that sex hormones have a hand in attraction, it means that the pill is going to have some hand in sort of, influencing the qualities that women are desiring in their partners.
Mm-hmm. But what people call, I guess, the ovulatory shift hypothesis, that is all of those changes that we see in terms of mate preferences, for example, across the menstrual cycle, I mean, that is not definitely proven, right, as you were alluding to, because recently I interviewed, for example, Lars Penke from Germany, and I think that he has been trying to replicate some of those results. And he told me that he didn't get anything there. Maybe perhaps when it comes to increasing their sexual activity when they are ovulating, that he got to replicate that. But when it comes to, for example, preferring a more masculine man, and even if they are partnered with a man that is not as masculine as others they are exposed to, for example, that, I mean, at least according to his data, it wouldn't seem that it is proven, at least, that women would prefer to have sex with more masculine, higher testosterone men.
Well, I mean, so I think that some of the most thoughtful and well-executed research that's been done on this topic, in particular, I'm talking about the research coming out of Jim Roney's lab at UC Santa Barbara, where he actually assays people's hormones on a daily basis and looks at within women changes in hormonal status and how that predicts they're within women preferences for partners and masculinity and this sort of thing. That research provides some really compelling evidence that when you test this in a really sort of nuanced, thoughtful way, where you're looking at within person hormone shifts and how that corresponds to within person shifts and preferences, it's provide some pretty strong support for the idea that there is a link between women's sex hormones inter-individually and what goes on in terms of their mate preferences, again, inter-individually. Some of these differences, you know, most of Lars's research is these big samples of people where they're sort of, you know, and they've done things where they've like estimated, I think, fertility status, maybe using luteinizing hormone presence. And it's like, I appreciate what he's doing with his work. I mean, I think that it's like so important to go out and test and see, you know, like who's finding what, right? And are these effects real? Because obviously that's like what we want to be looking at in science. But I don't think that, you know, like doing a really big, huge, you know, like less carefully controlled study and saying, well, you know, this other stuff that, you know, has been done in some cases, like, and it's not always the case. There's some people who've done research on this so-called, you know, ovulatory shift hypothesis that have not done things as carefully as like what's done on a, and again, I use as an example of what's being done on a Jim Murray's lab, because he's about the most thoughtful scientist I've ever encountered. He does such beautifully controlled, really thoughtful, hard to do research. Looking at these types of questions, and you know, I don't like I to me, I would be very, very surprised at the end of the day when we put all of these results of all this research into a sieve and sort of let the, you know, sort of things fall down where they are. I would be incredibly surprised to find that that women's sex hormones aren't influencing their preferences for partners and masculinity in particular.
Okay. I mean, when we talk about our species, Homo sapiens, people tend to say that we women have concealed ovulation. But is that completely true? Because as far as I know, and I read in your book and etc., it seems that there are some cues, at least, that apparently other women and men are able to pick up on, to tell, at least unconsciously, that that particular woman probably is going through ovulation. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, and that's like such interesting research. So there's a lot of there's research out there like suggesting that people are able to pick up on these cues to ovulation. And I mean, I think really, you know, what's going on is that our brains are wired to pick up on cues to estrogen presence. You know, whether that means, you know, sort of between women, right? So levels of estrogen, because of course, if you're picking up on estrogen levels, that's going to help you identify a partner who's fertile and, you know, has a relatively, you know, at least somewhat relatively high reproductive value, meaning that she's gonna be able to conceive for, you know, some period of time. And because of that, you know, because our brains are like wired to pick up on estrogen cues, then that suggests that, you know, at high fertility, when within women differences in estrogen are relatively high, that women are going to look a little bit better and seem a little bit sexier and smell a little bit better. And so the idea is that, yeah, ovulation might not be completely concealed and that people might be able to pick up on it. And, you know, and there's been, you know, some kind of cool research looking at men's ability to detect this, like Jeffrey Miller did that really provocative study that everybody always talks about, the exotic dancers. Right, where the exotic dancers at high fertility were earning more tip money than they were at low fertility, and compared to women who were on the pill. You know, there's also some kind of cool research that Jamie Krems did at ASU. Now she's at Oklahoma State, looking at women felt less trusting of a female target when she was pictured. It was a picture for at high fertility compared to low fertility. And I mean, ultimately, like, what I think, you know, I don't know necessarily that our brains are picking up on fertility per se. Like, oh, wow, that, I mean, fertility meaning in that momentary, or ovulation per se, I guess I should say, because it is fertility per se. But I don't think that necessarily that our brains are picking up on, you know, ovulation per se. It's just that our brains are wired to pick up on cues to fertility. And sort of between women, what that's going to look like is this preference for young, you know, women like who are really conceptive sort of across the lifespan. But within women, this is going to look like a preference for a woman at the time in the cycle when conception is possible.
So, I mean, we're talking about the pill in general, but there are different types of pills out there, right? I mean, is it the case that there are a few types of pill that are the most used by women? I mean, would you like to tell us about that? And also, what are some of the main biological or most relevant biological effects that they have on women's bodies, and particularly in terms of the levels of hormones?
Okay, no, so good question. So there are at least 100 different formulations of birth control pills out there. And of course, you know, this makes it hard to understand like what the pill does. It makes it hard to study because who knows, you know, what somebody is on. And, you know, and a lot of the research that's been done so far has just sort of created binary groups, like comparing women who are on the pill to women who are not on the pill, when, I mean, that both groups of women are going to be very heterogeneous, but particularly the pill-taking group, because there are so many different formulations that are out there. And the formulations, most women are on a combination pill, which has an artificial estrogen, so ethanol estradiol, and then an artificial progesterone, which is called a progestin. And most pills use the same artificial estrogen, but there's like four different types of artificial progesterones or these different types of progestins, and they're made out of different things. So some of them, most of them are manufactured out of testosterone, actually, interestingly enough, and then they're molecularly messed with in ways that make them able to bind to progesterone receptors. But depending on which of these different types of progestins you're taking, they're going to bind to different things in the body too and stimulate other types of receptors in the body, causing the brain to create these sort of experiences that aren't really sort of biologically normal. They're like these sort of unusual, you know, types of situations. And, you know, the most women in the U.S. are on second or third generation progestins, but in other parts of the world, they tend to be more on third and fourth generation because they break these down into different generations just based on when they came out onto the market. But they're all still in use, generations one through four. And so it's like really hard to know whether, you know, women who are taking this type of progestin, you know, they're probably going to look different than women who are on a different type of progestin. And like one thing in particular that I think is really important in terms of moving research forward, in terms of understanding what the pill does to women's brains, is really starting to at least, you know, even if we're not able to like break it down to the very specific brand and the very specific formula, is at least break our different research groups into what type of progestin is in their pill, because presumably that's going to be influencing sort of the you know, the hormonal message that's being read in their body, and that's going to have an impact on behavior. And you know, in particular, I'm thinking about now, there's been research in the U.S. Looking at women's mate preferences and how they change in response to the birth control pill. And this research finds that, you know, lo and behold, pill-taking women tend to, you know, they tend to prefer a different set of characteristics, and their relationship satisfaction once they go off the pill changes in relative to women who meet their partners when they're naturally cycling. And there's been other research that's been done in European countries. So in one particular study I'm thinking about was done in, I believe it was Finland. And the progestins that are used predominantly in both countries are different. And in this research I do believe it was Finland, found no effect of, you know, the pill on these, you know, types of relationship issues. And I can't help but wonder, you know, what's going to happen when we start sort of, you know, sort of breaking down the different types of pills that women are on, because, you know, different hormonal messages are going to cause the brain to do different things. And so I think it's going to be like a really important sort of next step in moving this research forward, is really making sure that we are really explicit in sort of defining, you know, what is the hormonal message that we're predicting is going to be changing these things. And then what is it going to do? Like, ultimately, what does it do? And this will also allow women to be able to make better choices about what pills they want to be on, you know, because if it turns out that second generation progestins can lead you to prefer these different qualities in your partner, but the fourth generation progestins don't, if you're somebody who's looking for a partner, you know, maybe you want to steer clear of the second generation progestin. So, there's so many research questions that are sort of raised by sort of understanding the different types of pills that are out there, and like the way that it can influence behavior or not influence behavior, and really sort of delineating important research for moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And this is important also for women to understand what are the different types of pills and also the effects that they might have on their bodies and their brains, more specifically, because, I mean, for different, it's not the case that the same pill even works the same way for different women, right? Also, because probably different women have their organisms and their brains organized in slightly different ways, even when it comes to, for example, receptors for those hormones, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the way that each individual woman is going to respond to any individual pill is going to be like really person dependent. And we don't really know a whole lot yet about, what is it that sort of, you know, causes people to experience things this way or that way. And it does. Yeah. I mean, if, the way that an individual person responds to an individual pill is going to depend on, you know, her sort of pre-existing levels of hormones before going on the pill. And yeah, the number of receptors for different types of, you know, these different types of hormones in their brain, the way that the, you know, all this other internal body chemistry stuff that we don't really fully understand, and neuroscience doesn't really understand. Like, I really, one thing that really sort of surprised me as I was putting this book together, and having to really get into neuroscience and neuroendocrinology, is how many black boxes, like magical black boxes, there are. Even because I always assumed that neuroscientists had it all figured out and that they understood how everything worked and, you know, the way that everything works together to create these experiences. But no, there's a lot of magical black boxes in neuroscience where they're like, all right, we know this happens, right? We don't know why, we don't know how, but it happens, and not really, sort of having a deep understanding. I guess I was, in some ways, I was surprised. I always assumed that, you know, some other areas of science that wasn't my sort of bread and butter, that they had it all figured out, and no, they don't have it figured out either. And so there's a lot of black boxes in terms of, you know, how women are going to respond to the birth control pill. And so like one of the, you know, messages is of the book is like, you know, hey, here's what we know about the sort of average way that women seem to be responding to the pill, and sort of here's why we should expect that the pill should influence these types of things that go on in the brain. But a lot of it is, you know, we still don't know enough. Like, there's a lot of magical black boxes, and if you're having an experience on the pill, and it's real for you, you know, it's real for you, and if you don't like what it's doing, then you look for something else, and you find find one that's going to work for you, or find an alternative means of, you know, protecting yourself against pregnancy, and really just advocating for, women's experiences, because I think that as a female, we tend to get written off by our doctors more frequently than men do for having, you know, like, gosh, I don't know, this medicine doesn't make me feel right. And doctors sort of, you know, well, no, that's not on the package insert. And so your experience isn't really real. So it's all in your head. And so, you know, a part of this book is also just like letting women know that, That no, yeah, it is in your head because that's where your brain is, right? But not in your head in that you're imagining this and that you're making it up. You know, we don't fully understand the range of effects that can happen in response to the pill. But whenever you take a hormone, because there's billions of hormone receptors throughout the body, it's going to influence every single one of those cells in your body that has a receptor for those hormones. And so there's, you know, it's going to have a wide range of effects. And it's going to be a little bit, you know, nuanced in terms of what it does to each individual woman. And so just like telling women, like, listen to what your body's telling you, because sometimes our bodies do things that science doesn't understand yet.
So when I first asked you about concealed ovulation, I guess I was also already alluding to at least a little bit to the fact that the pill not only has an effect on the woman's body, the woman that is using it, but also it might have an effect in other people, other women and men, because as we said, people are able to pick up on these cues that the woman is going through, for example, a particular phase in their ovulatory cycle, or if they are using the pill, I mean, there are the changes that you get don't occur exactly, right? So, I mean, is it the case that when women are on the pill, that might also have effects in terms of how other women deal with them and even more specifically their male partners?
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's research showing that, you know, that the pill, the women who are on the pills, like just even talking about that Jeffrey Miller study that we talked about with the lap dancers, and, you know, these women are earning less tip money than our non-pill taking women, which is a really nice field study, a way of like sort of assessing, you know, interest in particular women. And so there is that study, but there's also been other research showing that women, and this is also true not only for human females, but also for non-human primates, where you find that the pill-taking primates, whether it's a human primate or a non-human primate, that they're less, they seem less desirable to men. Like their scents are less desirable to men. Men who are in relationships with the pill takers, they're less likely to mate guard than the non-pill taking partners. In the primate research, they show that the females are actually less likely to be mounted, which is, you know, sort of an honest indicator of attraction in a non-human primate. I'm sure that the same thing works out for our humans, but we can't study that. The research tends to suggest that, you know, the pill is sort of creating this artificial context in which the normal cues that, you know, especially scent-based cues in particular, might really be being sort of decimated by the sort of hormonal profile that's created by the pill, in a way that sort of renders women less desirable to partners than what they are sort of might be if they're not on the pill. And this is, you know, kind of a big deal to women. I mean, the idea that you might be less, like a less desirable version of yourself in response to the birth control pill is sort of provocative.
Right, so that might have profound effects even if people don't notice them consciously on how they establish relationships and what might happen if, for example, they start a relationship on the pill and then they move out of the pill or vice versa, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we just don't. That can have a lot of, it can have negative implications for women's ability to attract partners. And it could, you know, have just, I think that what you were alluding to with women who choose their partner on the pill or off the pill is this research showing that, that if women chose their partners when they were on the pill, and then go off of it, or vice versa. Like what they call like non, I don't know, I think that they call it like non-concordance, or I think they call it non-concordance. I don't remember exactly what the researchers sort of termed it. But there's some evidence, and this is another one research area where the results are sort of mixed, where some results find it, some results don't find it. That women who are sort of non-discordant, where they were on, you know, on it, now off it, or off it, then on it, that this mismatch, this hormonal mismatch between who they were when they chose their partner and who they are now, can cause relationship issues and problems potentially. And like I said, this is another set of research results that has been a little bit mixed, where some people find it, some people don't find it. But so it's something that, you know, we need more research on moving forward. But, you know, it makes sense, right? If a woman's preferences for partners are influenced by their sex hormones, and you kind of change up what their hormonal profile is, that this could have implications for how they feel about their relationship, right? It might not, but it possibly could.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of mating strategies, is it the case that you also get some important changes in terms of, for example, adopting long-term or short-term mating strategies across the menstrual cycle? And would that mean that women on the pill don't experience those sorts of changes or not?
Right. Well, so because women on the pill don't have dynamically changing hormones across the cycle, which is what you get in naturally cycling women. With naturally cycling women, you get this big, you know, sort of increase in estrogen that goes on at the beginning of the cycle, and progesterone is low, and then estrogen spikes, and then it starts to decrease, and then progesterone rises, and that becomes the dominant hormone. And as we sort of see this ebb and flow between these two sex hormones, we see changes in women's, you know, sexual behavior and mate preferences. Although, like you were alluding to, some of that research is the results have been somewhat mixed. But so when you have the birth control pill, rather than having this like dynamic sort of yin and yang with these two hormones sort of across the cycle, you get the same daily hormonal message every day across the cycle. So it's always, you know, a relatively high level of these artificial progesterones or progestins relative to a relatively low level of estrogen. And so women, you know, naturally cycling women, if their different hormones are leading them to sort of cue into different things in terms of sexual interest and even the preferences that they have in terms of partners, we should expect to see that there is sort of more dynamic changes in naturally cycling women's preferences and behaviors, and that pill-taking women should be very consistent. Every day is the same day hormonally, and so every day, you know, we should expect that they're doing the sorts of the same activities. And their preferences should be the same sort of every day, invariant across the cycle.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about how women get affected by their hormones, and also what happens when we tweak the hormone levels, let's say with the pill and probably other means. So we're also alluding here to sex differences, right? And I guess that's a very or somewhat controversial topic nowadays, and not only nowadays, but I mean, it's been for some time a controversial topic. And it's interesting because in the first part of your book, I guess that in the introduction, you also reference a little bit this question about, let's say, the difference between sex and gender, or the more the more physical and behavioral / psychological aspects of women and men, and you refer to several different ways of classifying gender, like, for example, the genetic, the hormonal, the phenotypic, the behavioral / psychological. So could you tell us about that, and perhaps why people shouldn't be worried about studying biological differences between men and women?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, for a very long time, women have been like sort of treated I mean, you know, sexism is a thing, right? And I think for a really long time, women have been treated as sort of like just smaller, less rational versions of men, right? And so like historically, you know, if we look back to like Victorian era, you know, women were treated this way. And so as feminism sort of came, you know, to sort of be, you know, I think that it was like the sort of best defense that women had to try to argue for equal sort of pay and equal opportunities was to argue that we're absolutely no different than men, right? Like we're the same, we're the same, we're the same, we're the same. And so for a really long time, you know, that's been the battle cry of feminism. The idea being that women should only, you know, get the same things that men get if we just pretend like we're exactly the same as one another. And so like, you know, we're you know, the same and therefore we're equal. And so, and you know, and this is like, you know, 1970s, like politics type of stuff. But I mean, I think that that has been sort of, you know, the assumption that people have, right? Is that equality for women and men depends on being the same. And so for a very long time, it was seen as incredibly taboo to even, you know, suggest that men and women are different from one another. And you know, in my field, of course, you know, evolution psychology, where we talk about sex differences all the time, you know, we get a lot of pushback from, you know, people who think that by being different, you know, by saying that we're different, that we're somehow saying that women are less deserving of equal rights and all of this sort of thing. But equal rights and the ability for women to have power and, you know, and financial independence and all these other things isn't contingent on the idea that we're the same, right? And to pretend that men and women are the same is really dangerous to women in particular, because men historically, especially when we're talking about medical research, have been the ones who have been studied. And so this idea, you know, this like sort of null hypothesis that, you know, these sort of ideologues have, where it's like, well, women are just little tiny versions of men and we're exactly the same and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Even though it's really well-intentioned, this idea that, you know, we're the same as men, we're the same as men, we're no different, we're no different. You know, when it comes to the way that our brains work and our bodies work, we are really different. And you know, when we're assumed to be exactly the same, what happens is research is done almost exclusively on males, male animals, male cells, and male human beings. And then the researchers try to apply the results to women. And when it comes to things like medications, there's research showing that it's something like 80% of new medications are withdrawn from the market within the first year because of bad effects that they have on women. And it's because women aren't being studied enough. They're just studying men and then assuming that women's bodies and brains are going to be working the exact same way. And it's ludicrous. I mean, we know better now. We know that sex differences, like that men and women are different, and that, you know, and even, you know, people who want to sort of argue that we aren't, I ask those people to just like sort of take, you know, a pause for a minute, because it's really dangerous to, especially women's health and like understanding women's brains, to make that assumption, because they don't work the same. And evolutionarily, you know, there's theoretical reasons to predict that men and women are going to be different from one another. And there's been, you know, mountains of research showing that we are, and that we respond to the world in different ways, and our bodies respond to the environment in different ways, and our brains respond to things in different ways. And the only way that we're going to, you know, sort of be able to further our own goals as women is going to be able to sort of understand that you can be different and still be equal. And, you know, and also that, you know, sort of being, like to do otherwise, to ignore these things and just sort of try to, you know, cover them up and pretend like they don't exist is actually really dangerous to us and forwarding our own ability to take control of our health and who we want to be.
Mm-hmm. And it's not only that, but there's also that question about the is-ought dichotomy, right? I mean, if you're describing differences between the sexes, that doesn't imply necessarily that you have to treat people differently. Correct.
Right. Exactly. And I think that it's, when you get to issues that people care about, and of course, if you're a woman, sexism is something that we've all encountered, even though there's less of it now than there used to be. We all still experience it no matter where we are in our lives. And so it's important, it's an important issue for women. And I think that it's easy to sort of fall into that type of thinking, right? That is ought comparison and or sort of falsehood and kind of lead that to sort of fuel your thinking rather than actually having a thoughtful conversation about sex differences.
And I mean, you were referring to, for example, medical research, and I guess that applies mostly in terms of body physiology and things like that. But I mean, if we focus also on the psychological or behavioral traits, then I guess that knowing the sex differences could also be important at the level of, for example, psychiatry, clinical psychology, and even for some causes that we care about. So, for example, if we are talking about different sex distributions in terms of occupations and educational achievement and things like that. I mean, if we don't take into account that maybe men and women might indeed prefer different things, I mean, we could, even though we wouldn't want that, we could be making the lives of some people miserable just to fill some artificial quotas or something like that. I mean, do you agree?
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. I think that our ability to understand ourselves, I mean, whether like, sort of in a disorder clinical context like psychiatry or psychology, I mean, the whole reason that we have a field of psychology is so we can understand who we are, and part of that is understanding that men and women are going to be different from one another and then using that as a framework for, like you were talking about, understanding like why we see that there's sex differentiation in the different types of careers that people take, or why there's sex differentiation in the number of CEOs that there are, right? And like talking about the way that status sort of rewards are differently valued by men and women. And I think that really understanding the human condition, right, and everything that makes us who we are requires like sort of this like deeper appreciation of like what makes men and women unique from one another.
I would also like to ask you about, because in your book, as far as I understand it, you make a very compelling argument there against pure sociocultural accounts of sex differences. Because I think that what you say is that if that was the case, that our psychological differences, the differences between men and women, were completely explained by sociocultural factors, then that would be even more oppressive than them being explained by biological factors, because basically, whatever people would want men or women to be, they could impose on them. Is that correct?
No, that was a part of the book I really liked writing because I think it's so true, and I think that as evolutionary psychologists, we tend to do a lot of apologizing, like I'm sorry, like I think that there are sex differences, and I'm sorry, I think that it's biology. And I think that we need to stop apologizing and like just point out the fact that look, the idea that we are different from men because we've inherited this wisdom from our female ancestors, and we've inherited these qualities that led them without pause to be able to successfully survive their environment and reproduce, is like it puts women in a much stronger position than this like passive cultural acculturation view, because the idea that women are different from men exclusively because we've sort of mindlessly adopted these, you know, mores that were thrust on us by society, like really puts women in the position of being on the fainting couch, right? Just like listening to what people are telling them to do. And I think that that's a much more passive sort of role for it puts women in a much more passive position. And that's like not, and it trivializes really like what's like a really, you know, this really well-crafted psychology that we have, that we've inherited from our ancestors because they were able to survive in all these different types of environments and because they were able to navigate all the perils of romantic relationships and childbearing. And that's like a really cool position to be in as a female. Like I've got this wisdom, I've got a million, you know, millions of years of wisdom on my shoulders. Like that's like a much more sort of powerful position for women to be in than the idea that we're just like, you know, mindlessly waiting for somebody to impose cultural rules on us that we're gonna adopt and like some sort of an automaton and, you know, sort of go through the world as, you know, as fembot, like with these rules that we've absorbed. And so, yeah, I think that as evolutionary psychologists, like we are, like, I think our position is much more empowering to women than this other position. And I think that we need to stop apologizing for it and really kind of double down on you know that because I think it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but you know it's all the fault of men and toxic masculinity and the patriarchy. You know it has nothing to do with biology. It's just men that are mean and stupid and simple-minded and things like that. Yeah. And they basically created these systems to exploit women and. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and so on and so forth. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. Okay, so let's now move on. The last two questions would be about the leather part of your book. Mm-hmm. And you make some hypotheses and speculate a little bit about the impact that the pill might have had on our society since it was introduced like 50 years ago or so. And so basically one of the things that you talk about is how it empowered women. So could you tell us about in what ways that happened?
Yeah, so, you know, the pill has, you know, when we think about like women and our ability to achieve things and our ability to meet, you know, sort of educational goals and career goals, one of the biggest things that has stood in women's ability to sort of dream big for themselves has been the possibility of an unintended pregnancy, sort of putting them on the wayside. And, you know, because pregnancy obviously is a really costly endeavor for women. And it's something that, you know, if you're having sex with any regularity, you know, will probably happen at some point, you know, in your life, even if you're trying to be really careful. And so, you know, one of the hypotheses that I sort of put forth in the book or this sort of argument that I make is that, you know, the birth control pill, by allowing women to like sort of remove this possibility of unintended pregnancy from their horizon, right? Because even though we've had other forms of contraception, nothing has been as effective and as easy as a birth control pill. It basically puts your risk of pregnancy at zero. And this is like a really powerful position for women to be in. You know, our grandmothers and our great grandmothers, when they were sitting and planning, like, do I want to go to college? Do I want to get a master's degree? Do I want to get a PhD or an MD? They would always have to contend with this very real possibility that at any moment they were in a relationship that they could end up with a pregnancy that they have to deal with. And, you know, nobody wants to go into an advanced degree program in particular. I'm thinking a lot about advanced degrees just because, you know, usually start at age 22 or so in these programs, and you're not done until you're almost 30. You know, so I mean, this is a time in women's lives when they're having, you know, pregnancy, if you're not protecting yourself against sex, probably going to happen because women usually find themselves in relationships by that point in their lives. And, you know, for our grandmothers and great grandmothers who were sitting and trying to figure out, do I want to spend 6 years in medical school? They had as a very real possibility that halfway through, all that investment would get totally destroyed because they ended up starting a family. And like, we don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, we've got a really safe and effective means of being able to regulate our fertility. And by doing this, you know, I think it has allowed women to dream bigger. Like, we were able to dream bigger because we're able to plan. And I think that the ability to plan and to know for certain, you know, that between now and this time, if you don't want to have children, you don't have to. And of course, that was always a possibility, right? Women could get, you know, the back alley abortion. I think that abortion kind of goes in this, you know, safe, and if legalized abortions also kind of falls into this category of things that really allowed women to plan and then to be able to achieve. And the pill has been a big player in this. And so I think, you know, the birth control pill, again, along with legalized safe abortions for women, these two things together really have helped to propel women into a place where we're more financially secure than ever before. It's kept so many women out of poverty, and it's just this ability to plan and know that, you know, no matter what it is that you're going to do, your future is actually in your control, and it's not, you know, going to all of a sudden, you know, poof, because now you've got pregnancy that you have to deal with.
And another thing that you speculate about in your book has to do with the effects that the pill might have had at the level of the mating market, right? And I guess that has to do with the fact that on the pill, women are more easily able to achieve more on an educational level, and then in terms also of social status. And then, I mean, the ways by which we create new dynamics between men and women. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I talk about the way that the pill might influence men and their own sort of, you know, life. And, you know, one of the things that I argue in the book is that, the pill, because it's changed women's sexual behavior, and there's just no question about it. If you look at the frequency with which women were having sort of sex for recreational activity sort of prior to the advent of the birth control pill and after. I mean, there's a reason that they called it the sexual revolution when the pill kind of came onto the scene, and it's because it changed women's sexual behavior. Because we no longer had to pick a potential husband every time that we were going to have sex with somebody. We could be picking somebody based on these really superficial cues, right? Like men have been doing forever. And, you know, just have sex with men that we would have no intention of settling down with just because it was fun and maybe he was good looking. And so what I argue in the book is that when women are sort of more willing to have more sex with more men who have fewer signs of any sort of dad-like qualities, so having like achieved something or being ambitious and industrious and some of these qualities that women really look for in their long-term partners, when women are now willing to have sex with men who don't have those qualities, because we are able to do that now because we have the pill and we don't have to worry about these guys being the father of our children, I've argued that this might remove from men one of the most powerful sources of motivation that's ever been known to exist, which is trying to get sexual access to women. And so if men are able to get sexual access to women without achieving anything, I don't think that men will achieve anything. And there's this quote by Aristotle Onassis that I fell in love with the first time I heard it because I think it's absolutely spot on. And he once said, without women, all the power and money in the world would be meaningless. And it would be. I mean, it's like men get they want power and status and wealth and all of these things only in as much as it translates into better women, more women, you know, a better woman. Like men are very much motivated by sort of this ultimate, you know, end goal. And so when men are able to achieve that without doing anything, I think that it can lead to sort of a broad scale demotivation of men. And, you know, and we've seen that, you know, we've seen that men have really started to decline in terms of the numbers going to college, the numbers entering the labor force, what their income is. And I don't think that the pill and women's behaviors in response to the pill are like the only players in this. I mean, there's a lot of players. There's video games that are better than they used to be. And so guys, you know, are like becoming addicted to these games. You've got porn, you know. And so there's a lot of factors that are contributing to this. And so I wouldn't argue that this is the only factor, but I think that it's played a role for sure. And this isn't to blame women for the decline of men because, you know, it's not women's fault. And it's not women's responsibility to have to make sure that men are able to achieve anything. But rather, I just argue that, you know, the pill, by sort of changing what women do, can have these unintended consequences on the rest of the world. And we haven't even begun to really understand what they all are. And it's sort of just really a thought experiment about, you know, how is it that these small changes in women's behavior can change what men do and then change what the rest of the world does, and sort of, you know, sort of the meta issues with the birth control pill.
But, you know, if your hypothesis is right, maybe that would also explain why back in the late 80s, early 90s, feminists came up with third wave feminism, because maybe there were already a good number of women out there that were unsatisfied with the mate in mind. and the fact that men were underachieving, and so since they weren't able to get a proper partner, then they turned to, you know, third wave feminism and bashing men and blaming men for all their issues. And I mean, I'm just joking a little bit, but
he's like a little bit. I'm joking a little bit. I love it. That's perfect.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. It could be the case. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dr. Hill, it was really a pleasure to have you on the show again. And I really hope that the book sells well, because I already had access to an early version of it and I really loved it. So I recommend it to all my to my entire audience out there. And would you like to make reference to any other places where people can find your work before we go?
Sure. So I am on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and my handle is at Sarah E. Hill, PhD. And you can also find me online at www.sarahehill.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So I will be leaving links to all of that in the description box, and of course also to the book. So people, when it's out, and I think it will be tomorrow when this interview is out, go out, run and buy it, because it's great. So I recommend it to everyone.
And it's on Amazon for ordering right now. So get it while it's hot, folks.
Okay, so it was really a pleasure to have you on the show again. Thank you.
Right, thank you so much.
Hi everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. To keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Any amount, even $1, would already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you don't like Patreon, you also have the options of supporting me via Subscribestar or PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of the video. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and subscribe to the channel. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons Karen Litske, Anne Blanchett, Perelga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Brian Rivera, Lucas Tafiniak, Sergio Condriano, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, John Connors, Adam Castle, Vega Giddy, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Dr. Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, and Bo Weingard, and my three producers, Izar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.